First, a word about infection control. And the focus has switched from control to the term prevention. APIC, which is our international professional organization for infection control practitioners and epidemiologists, is promoting two name changes. One is that there, and have been for the last couple of years, promoting that the infection control departments switch their names or move their names to include prevention, so that you will see departments referred to as infection prevention and control or just simply infection prevention. Also, this last year, APIC rolled out an initiative to change the professional title of infection control practitioners to infection preventionists. And this is a move to along the lines of perfusionist, hospitalist, to follow in that particular vein of title, and to focus again on the prevention aspect of the job instead of the control aspect, because often we realize that we don't have any control, but we do a lot of negotiation, compromise, and trying to work with everybody. Well, let me, first of all, since we are an hour after lunch and to get you moving a little bit, I have a couple of questions for you. And how many of you know an infection control practitioner in your facility? And I mean, when I say know them, that you sit down and have discussions with them. More or less 50%. That's good. That's good. That's excellent. Okay. My second question is for you is, in your opinion, in your belief, does the infection control practitioner or the infection preventionist use the majority of their time to do disease surveillance and organism surveillance? No? You don't think that? Okay. And that is correct. We don't use much of our time anymore to do actual disease surveillance or organism surveillance. I kind of wanted to give you a brief synopsis of where I come from. And this is the University Health System. It is has over 600 licensed beds, but it also has 18 freestanding ambulatory centers, two of which are extremely large and were formerly hospitals. We also have the Bexar County Jail, Bexar County Detention Services, which is fascinating, and we have. So our scope of work is very, very broad in our particular facility. And on I have been on the roof of my building. I have been in the sublevel below the basement of my building, because we have to do a lot of work with plant engineering and renovation and all repair work. There's an infection control piece that has to be monitored within that. I also, we have to monitor all sterile processing procedures, so I spend quite a bit of time in the ORs working with them. And also, we have the unusual things, of which some of it is from being a county hospital. And the most unusual for me has been I've spent an afternoon on the loading dock disinfesting a patient's personal electric wheelchair of hundreds of cockroaches. So that is kind of the scope of work that I have. And as you can see, often I have more on my plate than I can actually chew. Well, the objectives today that I want to focus on are to bring an understanding of the regulatory environment that is currently occurring regarding healthcare-acquired infections. And those are going to be referred to as HAIs after that. The past term was nosocomial infections, but you know, we always are changing verbiage, and so now we're into healthcare-acquired infections. And we have county, state, and federal regulations that are, some are in committee, some are passed, some are, you know, being done. There are a lot of laws being passed regarding organism-specific reporting or surveillance, specifically MRSA, because it has become such a media darling. Long-term care is starting to get a lot of attention and will will be seeing more attention on long-term care, and there's actually a few laws out there regarding reporting of their healthcare-acquired infections. And then we have the Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services, which is a huge driver of a lot of what's going on right now in every institution in this United States, unless it is somehow managed to be completely private and have no Medicare, Medicaid patients. So those are the regulatory aspects we're going to talk about. And then I'm going to describe how mandatory reporting impacts the patient and the healthcare institutions where we work. And then I want to examine a few ways in which laboratory, pharmacy, and infection prevention can work together to control the impact of all these regulatory mandates that we are getting. First of all, let's talk a little bit about required reporting. As I mentioned, there are county-based initiatives. Now, these are generally pilot studies, more for gathering data to see what's feasible. The ones I'm aware of have been disease-specific, specifically MRSA, and they have been driven in large part by the local health department or the county health department in that area. And I'm aware of two county-wide initiatives in Texas. One was driven completely by the local health department, and they requested, the health department has a lot of oversight over your infection control or infection prevention department within your hospital. And but the health department requested kind of politely that to receive the MRSA data from various hospitals in their county, and they were given the data, and then the county health department was the one that actually took the data, cleaned it, manipulated it, and got results from it. So they just took the raw data that the healthcare institution provided them. The other countywide system that I have seen has been actually a state legislation that was specifically for a county in Texas, and what the request was that the healthcare institution provide specific data, but they had a list of what they wanted regarding demographics, was it infection, what was the treatment. And so they were requiring that the healthcare institution do all the legwork and provide all the data and feed that to the health department. The one that was a little more collaborative was successful. They got the data, they've published it, and they've moved on. The one that has been mandated has gotten stuck in the comment phase of the legislative process. We have state reporting. Many, many state legislatures have taken the banner of requiring mandatory reporting of certain healthcare acquired infections within their particular state. And it ranges the entire gambit from total healthcare-associated infection reporting, which is what Pennsylvania has to deal with, to very targeted reporting. So they're very disease-specific, type of infection-specific, and location-specific. So they are looking for central line-associated bloodstream infections in ICUs. They're looking for surgical site infections for specific surgery types. Those are a lot more successful than the total HIA reporting. But all of this statewide mandatory reporting has been driven in large part by the consumer union group. Well, what is happening in California? And this is, to the best of my understanding, reading the California actual bills, subject to interpretation, I suppose. But the current California law is, this is a synopsis of it, and it's been signed into law in 2006. And it, one, established a healthcare-associated infection advisory committee to advise the legislature on further implementation of laws. And the law basically requires that an acute care hospital implement various process measures relating to disease surveillance and prevention of HAIs. And it is really what it is a legislated infection prevention plan, which is also what Joint Commission requires that infection control do. As of January 08, certain aspects of the program were required to be reported to the California Department of Health Services. This law also establishes the HAI Advisory Committee to make recommendations for future legislation. Then there are two pending laws in California that have passed both the Senate and Assembly and are at on the governor's desk for signature as of yesterday, and the resources I had, they're still pending signing. The first one is the Hospital Infection Control Act, and this one basically expands on the current law and broadens it a little bit more, and it is a broad law, and it's seeking to implement the nationally recognized CDC Joint Commission Center for Medicaid and Medicare Services quality initiatives, regulations, recommendations, guidelines, in a structured manner throughout California's healthcare systems. This one requires the development of a statewide reporting system for California to be developed by January 2011. I also want to point out here that it is requiring the reporting of HAIs to the state and to the National Health Safety Network. And the National Health Safety Network is the CDC's electronic data gathering system. And we're going to talk a lot more about that in coming slides. The other piece of current California legislation is the Medical Facility Infection Control and Prevention Act. And this one requires all health facilities and nursing homes, I told you nursing homes are getting it, to implement specific screening, prevention, and reporting procedures. And one of them is the screening of high-risk patients for MRSA. Not all patients, just high-risk ones. To report to the California Department of Health Services, clusters of two or more in a 7-day period on a same location. Interestingly enough, it has very specific cleaning practices for your environmental services people. And it is going to require quarterly reporting of MRSA, VRE, and C. difficile healthcare acquired infections. And in 2011, it's going to require the mandatory reporting of central line associated bloodstream infections, and in 2012, it's going to require the mandatory reporting of certain surgical site infections. And the ones that they picked, I was fascinated, are exactly the ones that CMS is going to be using. And I'm amazed, I guess, by this, because this is something that they want to have in place for mandatory reporting by 2012, but yet this is something that CMS is instituting immediately, and with the regulatory environment morphing so rapidly right now, I can't imagine that CMS is still going to be on those three at that point in time, 4 years down the road. So it's kind of interesting that they have very tightly pegged this particular piece of legislation to something that probably will not be as pertinent, at least, in 2012. Well, here are a few maps of the mandatory reporting picture that we have going on. As you can see, most of the states are mandatory reporting. We have 15 that are not, and 6 that are studying bills. And probably what most states have learned is to have this healthcare acquired infection advisory committee to kind of guide the legislature, because this is complicated stuff for a state legislator to get kind of squared away. And that's been a smart move, and that's what we did in Texas also. Here we find the MRSA reporting laws and pending regulation. Now, this map still has California pending MRSA legislation, but with the passage of this Senate Bill 1058, it looks like there will be MRSA reporting legislation already. And you can see Texas there has the study bills that I mentioned. And then 4 states already have a mandatory reporting of HAIs for long-term care. And that will, I'm sure, will grow as time goes on. Well, what about federal reporting? The hypothesis is, right now, that the federal government is kind of letting the states work it out. and to identify the most favorable programs, the best reporting formats, and the systems, and kind of get the states all on board, see what works, see what doesn't work before they move forward with any gusto. And they just may leave it with the states, too, ultimately. But if the federal government does mandate or does legislate mandatory reporting nationwide, we are certain, almost 99% certain, that it will utilize the Centers for Disease Control and Reporting Network, which is the National Health Safety Network. Why? Because it's free, because it's established. it's already out there and being used. And interestingly enough, even between 2006 and 2007, hospitals are already preparing for this because the number of hospitals reporting to the NHSN network has tripled, more than tripled, from 2006 to 2007, and is still growing during 2008. these are bills that are currently in committee within the federal legislative bodies. VA always has some going on because they are guided so much by the federal government. There are the Community and Healthcare Associated Infections Reductions Act. There are several MRSA bills. The one I think my personal favorite is MRSA Awareness Month. And then there are other federal regulations. We can never forget tuberculosis. There's a bill in committee regarding antimicrobial resistance, which is excellent. We need to promote some of that more. There's the infectious disease products tax credit for you entrepreneurs out there. And I do want to say that infection control is a professional body. Infection prevention is a professional organization, a professional group, does support to a large degree the mandatory reporting initiatives and some of these particular pieces of legislation that are currently in the federal system. And the reason is if they are done well, we want to be players with them. We want to develop bills and legislation that is going to provide the best thing for our patients and cause us to do the right thing. And so we are not professionally, we are supportive of many of these bills as long as they're well written, well crafted, and well supported. Well, now we come down to Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, which is starting October 1st, which is next week. In 2005, there was the Deficit Reduction Act. This is what started all this. And it set requirements for hospital quality and annual payment update for reimbursement. And it started initially with qualitative initiatives, the SIP initiative, the Surgical Improvement Project, pneumonia, myocardial infection, those quality initiatives so that when a patient came in with these disease conditions, they were all treated the same and moved through the system the same. Well, in 2007, CMS started looking at healthcare-acquired infections and healthcare-acquired conditions. And so they implemented, for fiscal year 2008, they implemented the present on admission code so that they could define what a patient had when he was admitted and what he developed or got while he was in the hospital. And so that's been in practice for a year now. And the CMS finally decided, well, we need to start not paying for these healthcare acquired conditions. And so they issued the final rule for fiscal year 2009, which will start on October 1st. Now, these non-payments are completely DRG code driven, okay? There's no empiric evidence, there's no surveillance, there's no data gathering involved. It's strictly code driven. They have the present on admission code or they don't, okay? And they will, to manage them, they are going to require the implementation of evidence-based process changes. That's tantamount, because we cannot capture these as infection preventionist and as data surveillance and data gathering. We have to do this as a system-wide, process-wise improvement initiative. Well, here are the fiscal year 2009 healthcare-acquired conditions that CMS will not pay for if they occur on after admission. The first four, foreign object retained after surgery, air embolism, blood incompatibility, and stage 3-4 pressure ulcers, CMS considers never events. These are so serious that they should never happen in our healthcare institutions, and we should have redundant processes in place that prevent them. And so that is why those are first and foremost and why they will not pay for them anymore. Then they've included nursing issues such as falls and trauma, manifestation of poor glycemic control. This includes hypoglycemic coma and ketoacidosis. And they've also included deep vein thrombosis, pulmonary embolism, and my understanding is that is tied to orthopedic surgeries, especially knee replacements. And then there are several healthcare-acquired infection or infection-related ones. There's the Foley catheter-associated urinary tract infection, which for each case, a hospital loses $44,000. Now, we know that there's a lot of UTIs out there. There's the central line vascular catheter bloodstream infection, $100,000. Surgical site infections for mediastinitis after coronary artery bypass, that's $300,000. And then two others, the surgical site infection for bariatric surgery for obesity, and surgical site infection for a cluster of orthopedic procedures, which are spinal fusions and elbow and shoulder surgeries. Now, I do want to point out that the CMS picked these particular things. They had some certain parameters that they were looking at. One was that it was either high volume, high cost, or both, that there were good evidence-based practices available in the literature to prevent these, and that there was a coding system, and they have made changes to the coding system to facilitate this, but there were good coding systems to identify them, and so that it would be very clear that we were capturing the correct issues. So CMS is not done. They have some things that are still on the table that they are looking at for, that we know that they're looking at least next year. And these include delirium, ventilator-associated pneumonia, Staph aureus septicemia, Clostridium difficile-associated disease, and Legionnaires' disease. And I'm sure they'll add more. Okay. So what are we going to do? Well, first of all, I know that you guys know your bugs, but in infection prevention, 80 to 85% of the infection preventionists are still nurses, and they don't necessarily have the best the grasp of microbiology and molecular biology that you have. And I would encourage you to be open to educating and to helping and to mentoring your infection preventionist in these areas that you are experts in, and they need to have a better understanding. So you need to open that dialogue with them. But also, we need to be able to manage the impact of these regulatory these regulations that are coming. And one is that the infection prevention staff has to balance the focus of data gathering and getting information to and doing targeted and hospital-wide interventions and process improvements. And interestingly enough, is that in my world, to get a process improvement to occur, I have to be able to provide evidence that it needs to occur, hospital-based evidence that we need to do this process improvement. And then it loops back that once improvement's going on, that there's evidence that the improvement worked. Otherwise, people really don't want to buy into doing changes, as nobody wants to change, I guess. And so we do have to still keep that piece going of the capturing the data and providing good, solid, quality data to our hospitals. But we need to find easier formats to do that in. There are financial ramifications. First of all, you know, there's the poor presentation of data can bias consumer choice, and that is why infection prevention groups, infection preventionists by themselves in the APIC as a national body, has been very supportive and wanting to be at the table with all these legislative initiatives so that we can help define how the data is presented and how the consumer is going to understand that particular piece of data. Also, we have the CMS, the Center for Medicaid Services, is not going to pay for healthcare acquired conditions that they deem preventable. And then the non-payment, like we mentioned, is driven by that it wasn't present on admission. And then we have the issue of statistical confusion, because we cannot compare all hospitals to all hospitals. A rural hospital should not be compared to an urban hospital, and a teaching institution should not be compared to a small facility. So we have to find ways that we can stratify this data so that it's risk stratified and so that we are comparing like institutions. Well, that's where the NHSN is even more valuable. It allows for the risk stratification of surgical site infections based on the ASA score of comorbidities for the patient and the length of surgery. In a teaching hospital, surgeries go a little longer because we're teaching the surgeon. It also allows for stratification of risk based on ICU specialty. So a trauma ICU has inherently a higher risk of ventilator-associated pneumonia than a regular surgical ICU or a medical ICU. And so we can't be comparing a trauma ICU to a pediatric ICU. It just doesn't work that way. So we need to, the NHSN already has that built into its system. The pros are, well, I already mentioned it was free, but it's a national database, and it is very clean data. The input is rigorously controlled. Now, the cons currently, and the system can change, but the cons currently are that when they produce or collate their data, it's usually 2 or 3 years old by the time that data is presented back out. Updates are just inherently slow, and it is not highly user-friendly. Once you get used to it, it works for you, but it does take a little time to get used to it. Now, there are positive impacts for the patient, and one is that we are going to implement the best practices, the evidence-based practices, in all healthcare facilities across the nation. And really pushing for utilizing the Institute for Healthcare and Improvement bundles and the CMS quality initiatives. Now, in all this, and especially with CMS Joint Commission and IHI, the focus has always been on patient safety. And we're looking at a zero tolerance for healthcare-acquired infections as our goal. Now, this does not mean that we will achieve a zero, but the point is that that's where we're trying to go, that we're not going to be okay with 1% and then say, oh, I'm at 1% and I'm happy and leave it at that. No, it's always to strive harder to improve. And that the CMS is taking kind of the same stance with their never events. Now, there are a few negative aspects to the regulations. Mostly the ones I'm familiar with are related to active screening, especially for MRSA, because it leads to increased isolation precautions. And there is a lot of evidence out there that a patient that is in isolation precautions does not get as much contact time with nursing staff as patients that are not in isolation precautions. Then what can we do to collaborate? Well, it's increasingly important that the clinical laboratory scientist, the infection preventionist, and the clinical pharmacist work together. We have to come out of our individual silos and